And in fact, the middle chapter, the middle of chapter 1, verses 21 to 39, of what we have seen so far, could easily be entitled A Day in the Life of Jesus. It starts, that particular day starts at verse 29. After he has called those two sets of brothers that we thought about last week, at verse 29, we read, they went to Capernaum, and when the Sabbath came, Jesus went to the synagogue and began to teach. So that day begins. When the Sabbath came, he went to the synagogue and began to teach. And there he taught, exorcised a demon, and the people were amazed at his teaching. Then in verse 29 we read, as soon as they left the synagogue, so same day, they went with James and John to the home of Simon and Andrew. And there he healed Simon's mother-in-law. Now, the very lovely Alan has managed to recreate the slide that I forgot to send to church. And we can actually see what is believed to be Simon Peter's house. So on the left-hand side, this was discovered in the late 1960s. And it's a it was a typical house of the time, and it was close indeed to the synagogue in Capernaum. And it's been revered as a place of pilgrimage and thought to be Peter's house from the 4th century. So excavations lead us to think that, because although it was an ordinary house, it had alterations which were unusual to turn it into a place of gathering. And the graffiti, I love this sort of graffiti, the graffiti in Aramaic, Greek, Syriac and Latin mentions Jesus as Lord and as Christ. And then in the 5th century, an octagonal Byzantine church, which is what you can see on the left, was built over it. So it became a place, a formal place of worship at that point. And then today, so those were the ruins that were discovered in the late 1960s. And then on the right-hand side, bang up to date, they built another church on top of it. Nice modern building, but I suppose that protects the excavations. So that is believed to be Peter's house in Capernaum, where Jesus went and healed Simon Peter's mother-in-law, and where Jesus would have stayed and lived. And if you're privileged enough to ever go to the Holy Lands, I'm sure this will be a place that is worthy of a visit. Thank you, Alan. So that's so far, gone to the synagogue, preached, left, gone to the house. That evening, verse 32, after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all who were ill and demon-possessed, and then Jesus healed and exorcised demons. And Mark says, in typical hyperbole, the whole town gathered at the door, and Jesus set about healing those who were sick and releasing those who were held captive by demons. And of course, Mark specifically says that evening after sunset. Anyone want to have a stab at why that's significant? Sabbath ends at sunset. So it was the end of the Sabbath when he went on to do those healings. Think about that next week. So no doubt this particular Sabbath day was busy and tiring and demanding on Jesus. He's been teaching, he's been helping others. He's been the focus of attention in Mark's narrative and clearly of the people around him. He's heard all the amazement of the crowd. He knows what's going on. He does not indulge what we might consider a well-deserved lie-in, because after that day, we read in verse 35, very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went to a solitary place where he prayed. Now, while it was still dark, it really was very early in the morning, a long time before morning. N.T. Wright describes it as the middle of the night, actually. Jesus gets up, leaves the house, goes to a solitary place, and he prays. And as we go through Mark's Gospel, you might note that this is only one of three places where he talks about Jesus at prayer. Here at the beginning, in the middle, just after the feeding of the 5,000, and near the end in the Garden of Gethsemane, the night before he was crucified. And each instance of prayer that Mark records specifically refers to Jesus in a solitary position. Not just because he takes himself off or because it's early in the morning and he's the only one up, but also figuratively, when although the disciples were in the garden, they fell asleep and were not with him. So whilst Jesus has been this incredibly public figure, even at this very early stage in his ministry, when his fame is spreading, the crowds have been following him. There have been public demonstrations of power and the exorcisms of healing. But Mark clearly wants us to see that Jesus has this rhythm of personal, private prayer that goes on away from the crowds, away from all the public scenes and the clamour for more of Jesus. Excuse me. At these critical moments in his ministry, Jesus clearly takes himself off to be alone in prayer. And if we look at those three instances, we can see various similarities and contrasts. But in each, we can see that Jesus is in the midst of other people's demands and other temptations that might be trying to dictate his agenda. Excuse me. I would almost say talk amongst yourselves. Now, this theme of isolation for Jesus has already been introduced in Mark. Like Matthew and Luke, he tells of Jesus in the wilderness, one of the most significant events that sets Jesus on the course of ministry. It is, and of course, another period of isolation. After his baptism, Jesus is taken into the desert where he is tempted by the devil. And although Mark deals with it with just the briefest of details, we know that this is when Jesus refuses the temptation to power, prestige, and comfort. He refuses the devil's agenda and sets himself on the course of following God's agenda. And already, just these few verses later, Mark echoes this experience by describing Jesus taking himself off to pray again in the midst of the temptation to be blown off course and follow the crowd's agenda or even Simon's agenda. Having dismissed the temptations presented by the devil in the wilderness with a single word, and in the synagogue he has dismissed the demon again with a single word, Jesus withdrew to the home of Simon Peter, but there the crowds followed him. He doesn't send them away at that point. He heals and performs exorcisms. And he tells the demons to be silent. He's still in control. Having withdrawn from the synagogue, he then withdraws from that home to find a quiet place to pray. It is sometimes called a place of solitude, a lonely place, a deserted place. It was somewhere to be alone with his Father. Clearly, that was more important to Jesus than catching up on some sleep. But let's note, this time of prayer isn't in response to the grave and intense pressure of a Gethsemane experience.
So far, Mark has recorded no hostility or anger at what Jesus is doing, other than from the demons. Mark is showing us that though Jesus is the Messiah, he still spent time in dedicated prayer in his humanity as well. Now, after searching for him, I don't know how long after that was, Simon finds him and with a sense of urgency and perhaps even a hint of rebuke in his voice, says to Jesus, "Everyone is looking for you." In other words, what are you doing up here on your own when there's a lot of people out there who want more of you? And no doubt people that were in need. Simon is less interested in Jesus praying than in making sure the crowd gets what the crowd wants. He wants Jesus to follow the crowd's agenda. Now, to be fair, we can understand, I'm sure, Simon's attitude. He knows he's already decided to be a follower of Jesus, and he knows that Jesus wants to get his message across. And it would seem obvious to go to where the crowds are to catch their attention. But Jesus shuts this down immediately. Rather than engaging more healings there, he tells Simon that he is going to withdraw once more. He's going to remove himself from Capernaum and preach elsewhere. He refuses to go by somebody else's agenda. Verse 38, we read, Jesus replied, "Let us go somewhere else to the nearby villages so that I can preach there also. That is why I have come." So in this busy, clamoring 24 hours, Mark keeps the focus on Jesus and shows him withdrawing from the crowds to pray and withdrawing from the crowds to preach. He shows that Jesus is going to stick to his agenda and not that of anybody else's. And then we have a break in that particular timeline. Because verse 40 doesn't start with any particular indication of timing. As Jesus has commenced his ministry, at some point he is approached by this man with leprosy. Now, as some of you may know, in the Bible, describing somebody as having leprosy can mean a whole host of skin diseases, not just what would be strictly diagnosed as leprosy today. But under the Levitical laws, such a skin disease would render the person ceremonially unclean. And you can read about this at your leisure in Leviticus 13 and 14. Do you know what? I'm very glad I'm not a priest, a Levitical priest, with inspecting all those hairs and whether they've got a white spot in it. It's very detailed, possibly not for the squeamish, and certainly not while you're having your breakfast. But it's there for a purpose. It tells us this man was a social outcast, in a sense. He was spiritually unclean. He would have been ostracized in society. No wonder he comes to Jesus in his need and begs. He would have been desperate. And the way he phrases his request is very significant. Because he doesn't say, "If you are able, please heal me." He says, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." If you are willing, you can make me clean. So the man obviously believes already that Jesus has the power and authority to make him clean. He simply asks Jesus, "Are you willing?" He gives that agenda back to God, to Jesus. No matter how desperate he is, he gives the agenda to Jesus. And the passage leaves it open to us to wonder, did he mean being clean and healed from the disease, or ceremonially clean? Did he see Jesus as a healer or as the priest who would declare him clean? And in the first century, a skin disease was seen as a result of sin, So he was also asking to be made spiritually clean. If you are willing to clean somebody as sinful as me, is that what he is asking? Whatever it is, he presents his request to Jesus with the faith to say, "Your will be done." Now, verse 41 is the cause of much discussion in those who translate the Bible. The NIV that we've read today says filled with compassion, but it could also have an air of indignation about it. Was Jesus indignant at the man? Well, of course not, because he didn't usher the man away. And nor was Jesus concerned about his own ceremonial uncleanness, because we know he touched him. It would not have been the normal turn of events to touch anybody who was ceremonially unclean without becoming unclean yourself. But Jesus was willing to touch this man who everybody else would have thought was untouchable. And once again, with a single command, a single word, the man is healed. And physically, he is made clean. That is something an ordinary priest would not be able to do. So Jesus goes beyond what is humanly possible and once again acts in the power of God. But Jesus also very specifically commands the man to go to the priest to be made ceremonially clean, to restore him to temple worship, to restore him to society. And it shows us that Jesus wanted the law given through Moses to be honored and followed. So the man would know what it was like to be physically, spiritually, and socially cleaned. And this honoring of the law, in doing so, Mark is setting up the scene for what we're going to focus on in the coming weeks as we look at the next stages of Jesus' ministry. As we move into the next chapters, Jesus faces questions and challenges about the law. I can see somebody's already going ahead. Well done, Ingvar. As I mentioned earlier, Mark has not so far shown us any opposition to Jesus. The priests and the teachers of the law haven't really featured. Their shadow has been there in the on the wings of what we've read so far. But as we reach this end of chapter one, we are on the threshold of conflict, which is why, again, it's significant that Mark has told us Jesus wanted this man to follow the law and be declared ceremonially clean by the priest. But to go back to today's passage, throughout this passage and the question that we are looking at is whose agenda is being followed? Who is calling the shots here? And what we see is Jesus being willing to respond to the needs of the crowds or the individual who needs healing. He is on the side of the afflicted, of the outcast, of the desperate. But that said, he never lets this usurp his overall agenda. He didn't let the clamour of the crowds prevent him from his morning prayer, and he didn't let Simon's call keep him from the focus on preaching. And central to his agenda, central to sticking to his agenda, is Jesus' prayer life. As we should expect, he's the Son of God, but he is Jewish. He is reflecting the pattern of prayer established in the Psalms. In Psalm 5, verse 3, we read, "In the morning, Lord, you hear my voice. In the morning, I lay my requests before you and wait expectantly." In Psalm 88, we read, "But I cry to you for help, Lord. In the morning, my prayer comes before you." There is a daily rhythm of prayer outlined in the Psalms and a pattern that Jesus follows. It's a pattern that starts with the person of God, presenting their requests in daily prayer each morning. Now, I know some of you aren't morning people. There are examples in the Psalms where it says, and we had one at the beginning of the service, day and night I meditate on your word. But there is something special and important about starting the day focused on God and committing it to him, committing yourself to him. And if you look at the context of those Psalms, Psalm 5 and verse 88, for instance, the idea of presenting requests in those Psalms is not so much as coming up with a shopping list of, Lord, I want you to do this for me today, but of pouring out the heart cries to God about what is wrong. What is filling your heart with compassion and indignation for those who are in need? What is filling your heart with the eyes of Jesus as he looked on that man with leprosy and crying out to God from the desires of your heart? So whilst it might be in some ways quite an obvious lesson to say that if Jesus needed daily prayer and quiet conversation with his Father, then so do we. It's an important one. It shapes us. Making sure we go to a quiet place ourselves each day to be with the Father. It's not just a case of performative Christianity. Because in prayer, even as we do present our requests and pour out our heart to God for the things that fill us with compassion for those who are less well off, we are submitting to his will. In prayer, we bow, and it's a posture of humility. It's an act that says, Lord, keep me on track. Your will be done. When we pray, we are aligning ourselves to following his agenda and not getting sidetracked by an agenda that others might want us to follow. And it's not getting sidetracked by trying to get Jesus to follow the agenda that we want him to follow. There may even be things in our lives or opportunities that they look okay. Some of them might even look good. But it may not be the agenda that God has for us in that moment, in that time. Prayer exhibits trust that God will hear and act. And it exhibits trust that how he acts and when he acts are for the best. There is so much in this world that can keep us off track, can distract us and take us away from what is right and good and what is God's path for our lives. In prayer each day, we are saying, I want to align with your will to please you and live in your presence. And the other thing that we can remember from this passage is that it is part of God's agenda to reach out with compassion at the things that leave people on the outside. Jesus touched the untouchable. He was on the side of those who are bringing healing and cleansing. He was on the side of bringing people who are outcast in society back in. And as his disciples, if we are to follow in his mold, we should be willing to do the same. These are the words that we have sung in that hymn. I will feed the poor and hungry. I will stand up for the truth. I will take my cross and follow to the corners of the earth. Somehow it's kind of less challenging when we sing them, but those are words that we have said before God. Are we willing to do that? Because we might be called to reach out to people who don't fit our mold of who we think should be in the kingdom. But Jesus touched the untouchable, made him clean ceremonially, physically, and spiritually. So each of us can ask ourselves, where are we in this story? Are we part of the crowd just clamoring for the blessings of what Jesus can do and trying to make him do what we want him to do and not worry too much about the preaching, particularly when it's preaching repentance of sin? Are we Simon, hoping that Jesus will be a crowd pleaser and give the crowds what they want, keep everybody on side without too much challenge? Or are we willing to be one who goes to a quiet place of prayer, places our trust in him, and says, "Your will be done"? Amen.